Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we get to do a deep dive into one of our favorite topics on this fine show, namely what's happening with the SEC marketing rule and some of the recent guidance that's come out from the Division of Examinations and the Division of Investment Management. To help guide us through this conversation, we are very pleased to welcome back to the show Chris Mulligan and Jeff Blumberg. In our headline section, we first pay tribute to the service of former Commissioner Caroline Crenshaw, and we will also review a recent FINRA proposal covering the financial exploitation of senior investors and a new rule addressing suspected fraud for all customers. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of Outtakes, where we continue to see an increased focus from the SEC Division of Enforcement on insider trading and related fraud schemes. Moving into our headline section, on January 2nd, 2026, the SEC issued a statement regarding the recent departure of Caroline Crenshaw. In it, they stated, quote, Commissioner Caroline Crenshaw has devoted more than a decade of distinguished service to the Securities and Exchange Commission. Over those years, she has been a steadfast advocate for the agency's mission, demonstrating clarity of purpose and generosity of spirit. Commissioner Crenshaw has listened carefully, engaged substantively, and approached every day with the purpose of safeguarding investors and strengthening our markets. Those qualities are hardly surprising when you consider Commissioner Crenshaw's broader record of service beyond the agency. As a major in the U.S. Army Reserve JAG Corps, she brings to her work a spirit of duty and a sense of discipline that reflects the very best of what this country asks of those who serve it. We join our colleagues across the agency in thanking Commissioner Crenshaw for her service and in wishing her every success in the chapters ahead. We know that she will continue to have a profound and positive influence wherever her dedication leads her next, and we thank her once again for her exemplary service, end quote. The show would also like to thank Commissioner Crenshaw for all of her service during her tenure at the SEC. Moving to our next headline, FINRA recently requested comment on proposed amendments to rules covering the financial exploitation of senior investors and a new rule addressing suspected fraud for all customers. According to the notice, the proposals aim to modernize FINRA's rules to better prevent customer harm amidst rising fraud losses. For Rule 4512, also known as the Customer Account Information Rule, FINRA proposed permitting firms to use the term, quote, emergency contact, as an alternative to the trusted contact person to help increase customer adoption. The amendment would also provide flexibility for a customer to name a contact for use across all their accounts at a firm. Regarding Rule 2165, known as financial exploitation of specified adults, FINRA also proposed extending the maximum temporary hold period from 55 business days to 145 business days to accommodate potentially lengthy investigations by state regulators and adult protective services. FINRA also proposed new Rule 2166, known as temporary delays for suspected fraud, which would allow firms to place a temporary delay of up to 5 business days on disbursements or transactions for any customer, regardless of age, where there is reasonable belief of fraud. FINRA described this as a, quote, speed bump designed to give firms a brief window to intervene, contact the customer, and provide educational resources without the longer hold times associated with senior exploitation cases. In addition, the proposal included modifications to broaden the scope of personnel authorized to place holds under Rule 2165 to include staff in specialized fraud prevention roles, rather than limiting authority strictly to supervisory, compliance, or legal personnel. The amendments would codify guidance permitting firms to extend holds based on oral requests from state or federal authorities. Comments on the proposal must be submitted on or before March 9th, 2026. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we're going to be talking about one of those subjects that I feel like has to be the most talked about compliance subject inside their respective firms. It's one that quite literally every single firm out there has to deal with, and one that often involves quite a bit of pushback or discussion between a couple of the key divisions inside of any firm, namely marketing and compliance. And specifically, we're going to be talking about the SEC marketing rule, some of the more recent guidance that has come out in the form of a risk alert. But even before we get into that, I think there's even some more recent guidance that came out in an FAQ that I think will be super instructive today. But before we get into all of that, I'm actually thrilled to welcome back into the show a couple prior guests that we've had on before, and two gentlemen who have just a ton of expertise in this area, Jeff Blumberg and Chris Mulligan. And so excited to be doing this show with both of you. Maybe before we dive into the subject matter proper, why don't we do some brief intros? And Jeff, I'll kick it over to you first.
Thanks, Patrick, and thanks again for inviting me today. My name is Jeff Blumberg. I'm a partner with Fagree Drinker in our Chicago office, part of our investment management group. I've been doing this as an attorney for about 25 years, and before that, I spent 7 years working in the industry before compliance was really compliance.
That's right. Before compliance was even cool, Jeff Blumberg was there in the trenches. Love it. Thank you, sir. And Mr. Mulligan, over to you.
Hey, thanks, Patrick. Great to be back on the show. Always fun. Chris Mulligan, partner at Weil Gotshal, where I specialize in private fund regulatory issues. I've been here for 2 years. Prior to that, I spent 12 years at the Securities and Exchange Commission, mostly in the Division of Examinations. And I spent a lot of time on the marketing rule at the SEC, and I spend a lot of time on the marketing rule now that I'm outside the SEC.
That's right. Same boss, new boss, you know, we're doing a lot of the same work, but appreciate your insight and guidance and feedback there, Chris. So why don't we kick things off, you know, as luck would have it, as we're, you know, coming up to record our show today, just very recently, the SEC pushed out another FAQ on the SEC marketing rule that, you know, specifically talks about a footnote, and one that has, I think, raised quite a bit of conversation regarding the use of model fees and what needs to be included and not included. And so maybe, you know, Chris, I'll kick it over to you. Tell us, what did this, you know, recent FAQ pushed out from the SEC? Let's start by saying, what did footnote 590 say? What was some of the pushback from the industry? And what does this FAQ help to clarify?
Sure. So I think this FAQ is going to be very welcome by the industry. And it really stems from the fact that the rule itself does not seem to require a model fee. Net returns are defined as gross returns minus, you know, the fees and expenses you pay the advisor. It's a pretty clear definition. And it provides guidance around how you can use a model fee, but doesn't really require it in the rule itself. However, footnote 90, and this is why it was so controversial, in the marketing rules adopting release, said that if the fee to be charged to the intended audience is anticipated to be higher than the actual fees charged, the advisor must use a model fee that reflects the anticipated fee to be charged in order not to violate the rule's general prohibitions. This has really left the industry scratching its head, because folks thought that you could always use actual performance, actual net performance, and that it was only the use of a model fee that triggered all these additional requirements. And that is what the rule text says. But this footnote seems to imply that you might have to use a model fee. And that really created some confusion with the industry. And this FAQ comes along and basically overturns that. It says that the SEC staff will now review all facts and circumstances surrounding the use of actual fees versus a model fee in calculating net performance, including relevant disclosures when considering whether such calculations comply with the marketing rule. The FAQ clarifies that there are a range of options advisors can use in addressing circumstances where the fees of the product advertised are lower than the fees of the product being offered. So what this is demonstrating is clearly, I think, the Division of Investment Management heard industry. They heard the problems around this footnote, and they effectively overturned it. They said, look, you have to tell people that the fees are going to be higher in the product being offered. But there's a range of options to do that. You don't have to use a model fee and recalculate all performance. You can, you know, include footnotes and additional disclosure. It's very vague in terms of what it says you have to do, but it clearly contemplates there being a variety of options. And that really helps clean up what I think was one of the most problematic statements in the marketing rule release, and also just really demonstrates, I think, that the Division of Investment Management is listening to legitimate concerns from industry.
I thank you for that helpful background and context. I can definitely tell you I had some very tense, I'll describe it, tense conversations with, you know, private fund managers when they were looking at this rule, and I would have to tell them that they could not use the actual fees. That, like, they would have to go back and do some recalculations there on certain parts of that in under, again, depending on the scenario and the target audience in which they were hoping to send out a pitch deck to. Those conversations went over about as well as a bucket of rust.
Because of a footnote.
Well, right. Chris, would you agree that that was kind of a relic of the prior SEC's aborted attempt, or not that much SEC, but the SEC's leadership's aborted attempt to change the Advisors Act from a principle-based rule to a process-based rule like the 40 Act? There aren't many things in the Advisors Act that say you have to or you can't. It's very much principles based, and I think this FAQ is putting us back on a principles based standard, which is you can't mislead somebody, but you don't necessarily have to use a model fee if there are other ways to get to the same place.
Yeah, I mean, this was Chair Clayton's rule, so I think it was an attempt to really give some teeth to the general prohibitions. Because they cite the general prohibitions. They don't cite the performance section of the rule in the footnote. They cite the general prohibitions. So they're saying the seven general prohibitions effectively require you to do this. And that was a tough pill.
Good point.
That was a tough pill to swallow for folks. Hmm. I'm very happy to see them reverse course here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the one big thing to take away is that you still just can't argue we only charge 1% for the past 20 years. So the fact that we're bumping it to 1.25% now, we can still use the 1% and leave it at that. There's more to the story there. You can't
But at least there's an option. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
This gives our clients some room to find ways to comply.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Without recalculating 20 years of performance.
Exactly, which is a big undertaking.
Yeah. Well, look, I appreciate that. And I would say, you know, thank you to the Division of Investment Management for pushing out the FAQ to help clarify that. So at least with at least one conversation, I'm going to have one less tense conversation about a client on performance fees, at least as a result. So that's fantastic. Thank you both for that.
There was one other FAQ that they changed. Did you see that, or that they added? I guess.
And on testimonials and endorsements, is that right?
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning. I mean, it seems pretty obvious, but I think it's at least worth mentioning in the disqualifying events language of the marketing rule. There's a carve out for an SEC order if the SEC doesn't say that this bars you from this activity. So we have a lot of times when we go in to negotiate with the SEC for a settlement order, we will put into that negotiation a statement that this does not, you know, make you a bad actor under the following rules, so that it carves it out, and you don't end up with a situation where you can't receive referral fees or can't use a 506 offering. And this FAQ basically said the same analysis applies to an SRO, more or less.
Okay. Got it. Yeah, well, that's good information, especially for those firms that may have, you know, an active pipeline of, you know, solicitors and promoters and other folks that are performing those types of services, to keep that in mind. Thank you, Jeff. Yeah. So let's dive in and talk a little bit about the risk alert. So the risk alert comes out, it's published on 15th of 2025. And, you know, there are certain parts of it that I think will be good for us to kind of get into some of the nitty gritty. But I guess Even before we get into that part of it, specifically in the substantive content, I want to take a quick step back and maybe try to set the table a little bit. And I'm sure many of our listeners kind of understand the risk alert process and how that works inside the Division of Examinations. But I guess maybe, Chris, just especially with your background as a former regulator, I'd love to get your thoughts on, talk to me a little bit about kind of risk alerts generally, and maybe even dive into some of the impact they can have on examinations and enforcement.
Yeah, absolutely. So risk alerts are a really important part of the Division of Examinations, and they really express what the staff is seeing on examinations, right? So the priorities come out every year, receive a lot of attention. You know, the reality is the priorities are often very similar year to year. They're sort of focused on the issues that, everyone generally knows they're gonna focus on. And it doesn't talk about the results, like what did you actually find on these exams? And that's where the risk alerts really come in are, I think, are really terrific documents that help tell industry, in an anonymous way, hey, here's issues that you're seeing. This can really help CCOs. When I was there, and that trend seems to be continued, is your audience is CCOs. That is the audience. You're not trying to have a bunch of legalese, not trying to make them very complicated. You're trying to be very clear and pretty short. Because we know CCOs are very busy. These are issues that we are seeing on, this is issues that SEC are seeing on examinations and try to fix these. And it also reemphasizes the importance of the issue, right? So marketing did not receive a ton of play in the priorities this year. I think it's mentioned once. It's certainly a priority. And part of it may be the fact that it's been such a big part of the priorities the past few years that it received a little bit of a diminished view in the priorities this year. I think this risk alert combined with, frankly, those of us in the industry who are working a lot on examinations know already is that the marketing rule is a very big part of examinations. There's been a lot of enforcement activity around the marketing rule. The marketing rule is not to be taken lightly. But to the extent there were any doubters or folks out there that weren't sure after seeing the priorities, whether or not the marketing rule is a big priority, I think we can put that to bed. It absolutely is a priority of the Division of Examinations and likely the Division of Enforcement. And so we're going to continue to see that. The other thing that these risk alerts do is they communicate not just externally, frankly, they communicate internally too. They tell examiners. Exams is a huge program. I think people don't quite understand. I mean, there's 600 or 700 IAIC examiners. They conduct 3,000 exams a year, right? There's a lot of people in the Division of Exams. And when they see there's a risk alert on a topic, it's going to make them pay attention. It's going to make people in enforcement pay attention, right? That they understand this is an issue that's out there. So it just brings a lot of attention to whatever topic it is they're talking about. And so it has, its primary focus is an educational tool, I think, for the industry, but it also has a significant impact within the SEC and within what people are thinking about as they're conducting examinations.
Yeah. No, super helpful. Jeff, anything to add to that, just as far as kind of risk alerts and their impact? And maybe as someone who works with a lot of different registrants on the kind of industry side of the fence, any reaction from that side, you think, when they see a risk alert come out?
Well, the one thing I think we need to make sure we add, and we talked about this briefly when we were prepping, Chris made a point of this, I think, is that once it's been published in a risk alert, it's far more likely to end up as a referral to enforcement if you get it wrong. It's very clear across the industry that this is the SEC's position now, so you need to pay attention to it, because if you don't pay attention to it, you're far more likely to end up with enforcement breathing down your neck than just a deficiency in your exam.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, and it strikes at the heart of one of the items that that Chris had mentioned. Even inside, when a risk alert gets published, it puts everybody on the staff, especially those that are in the Division of Exams, on notice, and what they should be kind of cluing into and looking out for. But then obviously, if you're on the industry side and you see it in a risk alert, you absolutely need to make sure that you're paying attention to that. And it could potentially be for some of those other compliance officers out there who may have felt in certain areas with regard to their own firms, you know, marketing and advertising practices, like they were screaming into the void, right? Like they've been trying to maybe get something done or make a point, and the business just keeps pushing back and saying, I don't think that's necessary. No, this type of hyperlink disclosures are totally fine. Something that's a bit right.
The SEC hasn't brought an action, so why do we have to do it this way? Well, exactly. this is that middle ground. They haven't brought an action yet, but they've made it clear, here's what we think is appropriate, here's what we don't think is appropriate. So I agree. It definitely gives the compliance officer some additional ammo to go back to the senior management and say, here's how we need to address these issues.
Yeah, they haven't brought an action yet, but let's not be the first one and making sure to avoid it by adhering to this risk alert. All right, well, that's super helpful. Thank you both for helping to set the table there a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about what the content of the risk alert itself says, right? And some of the specific items that we'll dive into today. You know, we'll talk about testimonials, endorsements, we'll talk about third-party ratings, but let's start with one that I think, you know, testimonials and endorsements still, to me, is one of, if not the kind of biggest change that was present in the new marketing rule that obviously previously had been prohibited right under the old advertising rule. And so maybe, Jeff, I'll start with you this time. You know, tell me a little bit about some of the items that were particularly flagged in the risk alert in the area related to testimonials and endorsements.
Well, sort of looking at it from sort of 30,000 feet, when I read this risk alert, the feeling I get is that there were a lot of industry participants that hadn't bothered to read the rule. I mean, that's the feeling I got, because the very first point the SEC makes is making sure that you know when you're using something that is either a testimonial or an endorsement. And that is fundamental to compliance with the rule. If you don't realize you're using an endorsement or a testimonial, you're not going to bother complying with the rule. So that's the first step, is to make sure that compliance, and I would even say senior management, needs to read the rule and understand what it applies to. You know, in testimonial endorsements, it's really not that difficult. You know, I tell people a lot that what we do is not rocket science. Sometimes the rules interact in weird ways and that gets complicated, but each rule standing on itself is really not that hard. So if you spend some time and read through it and making sure that you know when these rules get implicated, you're 9/10 of the way there. And then after that, making sure that you have policies and procedures around how you're going to use that. That's what I think, those two pieces right there, I think, underpin everything that the SEC said about testimonials and endorsements, except for that one point that you mentioned that we're going to talk about more, which is hyperlinks. That one was a gray area, I think, up until this risk alert came out, and I don't think it's gray anymore at all.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Chris, anything to add to that? Just kind of at the top, you know, 30,000 foot level of some of the content in the risk alert?
Well, I think what's been really interesting about this risk alert is reading in the context of the other risk alert. So there were a number of risk alerts that were announcing exam initiatives that were about to begin, but we really had one substantive risk alert on the marketing rule, and that was from April 2024. It was about findings regarding the general prohibitions, right? Things about things can't be misleading, things have to be fair and balanced, you can't leave out, you know, material information, references to past specific advice in a way that's fair and balanced. And I think what's really interesting is that initial list of deficiencies really would not have been terribly out of place under the old advertising rule, right? The general prohibitions, mm-hmm. to a great extent, sort of codified a lot of the no action letters and reflected a lot of the old principles from the old advertising rule. So while it was an interesting risk alert, it really was something that I think people were very used to, were topics that people were very used to. Again, some of the nuance was different, but it was of a very comfortable place. I think, you know, we've jumped now to a risk alert that is about sort of brand new features, right? Things that used to not be able to have endorsements, right? And now you can, and there's all these new requirements around it. So in some ways, this is really the first risk alert about major new features and observations around those features from the division of examination. So and that way it's just really interesting to see how firms are sort of dealing with the new tools they have, right? You can now do these things, but there's obligations that come along with them. And obviously exams identified some issues with them.
Well, just one clarification, Chris, because I still don't quite understand why the SEC made the distinction between testimonial and endorsement. Endorsements have always been allowed. That's just the cast citation free. It's the testimonial piece. And I don't know why they made that distinction that, why do we need the distinction between whether it's a client or a non-client if they're giving you advice or making a recommendation under this rule? I think it's ultimately the same result. But the new piece is that you can now use client experience in your advertising.
Yeah, agreed. But when they revoked the Mayor Brown letter, now you have private funds dealing with really endorsements because they used to be able to use broker dealers without having to worry about the cash solicitation rule. So for private fund advisors, they really are dealing with this concept for the first time. But totally hear you on non-private fund advisors.
I think the majority of the private fund advisors in the world comply with the cash realization rule anyway, even though technically you're right, they didn't have to, and the SEC admitted you don't have to. I think as a best practice, a lot of firms made appropriate disclosures anyway. All of my clients did, certainly.
Yeah. So let's talk about disclosures, because that's actually an item that I think is super apparent that the staff is seeing some folks. And I think one of the points you raised earlier, Jeff, is well taken in that, you got to make sure you read the rule, right? And one of the parts of the rule when it comes to testimonials and endorsements is that you need to make sure you are providing certain disclosures involved in that, including whether or not the person providing the testimonial is the testimonial endorsement is a client or not a client, whether any cash or non-cash compensation was provided, and a brief statement of any other material conflicts of interest. So one, it's, I think, making sure that those disclosures are included, but that's not the only part of the disclosure, that's not the end of the conversation, right? It also matters, I think, where the disclosure is at and whether or not it's meaningful. And maybe, I don't know, Jeff or Chris, if you
want to say. I think we need to take a step back before we get to what the disclosure says, because there is one scenario where disclosures aren't necessary. And just to be very, very clear, and we talked about this briefly when we were prepping the whole entanglement and adoption concept. A client or a non-client puts something out into the world that the advisor doesn't control and they're not getting paid. So it's still an endorsement or a testimonial, but it's not paid and it's not somewhere that the advisor controls. There are no disclosure obligations.
Right.
So for instance, if I go on to Yelp and post, hey, you should talk to Patrick's advisory firm. They're great. I've made hundreds of millions of dollars with them, blah, 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 but I'm not getting paid and your firm can't do anything with Yelp, then these rules don't apply. Mm-hmm. That's one thing to keep in mind, is that, things that are completely outside the advisor's control and there's no payment involved, don't get implicated into this rule.
Yeah. Yeah. Essentially, if you have an existing client or investor, or if you have someone that you interact with daily, maybe it's another professional service that you share clients with or whatever else, and they basically go out on social media or wherever and do you a solid. Right. Without you having done anything to there's no quid pro quo involved. There's no comp. There's no whatever. Then that's just them doing you a solid, and it wouldn't qualify, wouldn't trigger as an advertisement underneath the rule.
Exactly.
Now, when you're involved in the preparation of it, or obviously there's a quid pro quo or other stuff involved, then it starts to get into this area where you do need the disclosure.
Right. So then the next step is, okay, so now it is either it's on my website as an advisor, it's on my Slick that I send out to clients, or I'm paying somebody for it. Now we get in, okay, what disclosures are necessary and what does that look like? And so that's where I think that's where you started the question, which is, what do we need to do? And as I mentioned earlier, the one gray area that I had was whether or not. So I have on my website, Jeff Blumberg, my client, here's Jeff's experience with us. And then there's a link that says for disclosures, click here. Mm-hmm. And the SEC has clearly said in this risk disclosure, that is not sufficient. Okay. That a hyperlink to disclosures is not clear and prominent.
Do you think it matters? So great, great call out, because I definitely know that there are advisors out there that and even at some of the conferences and other stuff, you hear compliance officers talk about that they're approaching it in that manner. Do you think it matters or not? Let's say that the testimonial or endorsement occurs on a platform. And again, I'm kind of making this up, but that where you like, there's a limited number of characters that you can put onto a particular post, and or where, you know, there are other ways, like where it's easy access to the link. You don't have to like copy and paste anything. Do you think that, are those just mitigating factors basically that might lessen the deficiency, or do you think it helps avoid a deficiency in that area?
I think that, again, the first step is to go back to the fire point, which is this an advertisement or not? Because, you know, if they're on my website and my website limits what they can put, having a link, I don't think that's going to help you based on this risk alert. Chris, would you agree with that?
Yeah. No, I mean, clear and prominent, that's from the release. I mean, the release talks about what clear and prominent is. And I mean, it is important to understand, like, these are not, and this is not guidance, right? And I can tell you, exams goes to great lengths to make sure that they are not issuing guidance. So there should be nothing new in terms of like guidance or no action or anything like that, right? That is the Division of Investment Management. Risk alerts is not guidance. And in fact, if you're ever on a panel with anyone from the SEC, you call a risk alert guidance, they will likely correct you, right? They are observations. And so they're generally supposed to be down the middle of the fairway. And there's a lot of discussion in the release around what is clear and prominent and what is not.
So for folks that are using a medium where they don't have complete control, like a Google or something like that. So like sometimes let's say a firm at the end of a Zoom call, you know how there's that pop-up window or whatever that comes up. Let's say it says, hey, thanks for joining us today. And if you had a great experience, you know, please share it. Correct. And it takes them. So we've entangled ourselves in the process now because we've solicited that feedback. It takes them to a Google page, and then they leave a review on the Google page for that firm. Would you expect then, obviously, the firm's going to have to follow up with disclosures? It sounds like, and I'd be interested in both of your thoughts, that having just a link to the disclosure is probably not enough, but that you would want to have the full disclosure underneath that post that was provided.
That's what
it's on the advisor website. Yeah, absolutely. It's on the advisor website. Yeah.
But even if it's on a public Google site that the advisor somehow sends people to and has some way to curate it.
Correct. Where they can provide a response, right? Because they've pushed the client to the place by soliciting them to leave a review, and then they go on and they leave a review. So now they've got to add a disclosure. Then it sounds like if they said, you know, for more information regarding this client testimonial, please visit blah. You're saying that's probably not enough. They probably need to put the disclosures on the Google page.
Unless there's a way that there's not a way it can be done.
I think Google has issues with links, but which is probably another reason potentially why they might want to add the full body of the disclosure in the thing itself. But
I mean, the more conservative approach is just don't solicit that review because you don't have enough control and you can't be sure that you're complying with the rules. So just don't solicit it. And that way, if the client does go do it, it's not solicited, you're not entangled, you're not adopting it, not paying for it, so the rule doesn't apply. So much safer. This is an area, and Chris, I'm guessing you and Patrick both agree here. This is an area where, given the attention being paid, you don't want to play close to the line.
Yeah, Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think another area with people going off and doing their own thing, which obviously this is a free country, right? Anyone, you can just go off and say what you like about an investor about an advisor on Google or anywhere else. But it's important to distinguish, and I find that sometimes clients have trouble distinguishing between de minimis compensation and any compensation, right? De minimis compensation, if you're below that, it certainly gets you out of a lot of the requirements for endorsements, but it is still an advertisement, right? Because you are paying them to go out and say something. And so, you know, it was mentioned here, there was some gift cards that were handed out, right? It is an extraordinarily low bar for an endorsement to become an endorsement and an advertisement for compensation, right? Literally a dollar does the trick, you know, gift cards, anything like that. And so, you know, truly, if someone is off saying whatever they want to say about you, that is their right. That is their obligation. You have nothing to do as long as you don't link it, solicit it, anything else, you're fine. But the moment there's any compensation paid to them for that, and, you know, that can be tricky too, because some people are like, well, I'm paying them for being a client. I'm paying them for the appreciation. You know, there's going to be a lot of skepticism about any sort of compensation going to someone who then turns around and provides an endorsement. So that's another important thing to think about. De minimis is a very important concept, but it's not at all a concept in terms of whether or not something is an ad or not.
Yeah. And to Chris, to your point about saying, well, I'm not paying them for the referral, I'm paying them because they're a good client. I think a strong factor there would be, I did this for 10 of my 100 clients, and those 10 sent referrals, the other 90 didn't. As opposed to, I sent it to all 100 of my clients. It wasn't for the referral. I just sent it to all, you know, I sent them all a holiday basket.
Right.
Or I sent my 20 biggest clients a holiday basket. It's facts and circumstances. And you have to have an objective rationale for why you paid somebody something if it's not because they referred somebody to you.
Right. Right. And the more it looks like a quid pro quo that you've done something as a result of them having provided the testimonial endorsement, the more there's going to be looked at with a healthy amount of skepticism.
Yeah, exactly.
What about, by the way, these are all fantastic examples, and I'm glad you called out the gift card one, Chris, because that is one that we hear all the time. And as you mentioned, like, not if it doesn't meet the de minimis stuff, that just means basically you don't have to have an agreement in place. It doesn't have to be written down, right? But like, but there's still all the other rules still apply. We still got to provide right disclosures. What about DBA websites? Or like when folks are, you know, engaging in certain practices, you know, their registration is with a kind of an RIA aggregator type or whatever else, but they operate as a DBA of that. Any special considerations that you would want to give to those folks that are operating as a DBA, or is it pretty much kind of just par for the course there?
I would say it's the same analysis. I don't see how it would change. Chris, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, the risk clerk calls that out. You know, testimonials and endorsements were often presented on the advisor's websites, including websites using alternative business names of their supervised person. So, you know, look, there's a lot of directly or indirectly throughout the rule. It basically, if you are in control, if you are making decisions regarding any of this content, it's very likely to be yours. I mean, there can be entanglement questions that become difficult, you know, when there's sort of a mixed use of certain things. But, you know, the general rule is if you are in control, you're making decisions regarding content. It's not just someone out saying whatever they want to say. You need to think long and hard whether or not, you know, it becomes an advertisement.
Okay, one more I've got on testimonials and endorsements, and then would love to get any kind of final thoughts on that before we move to third-party ratings. What about, we get a lot of questions, I'm sure you all do too, about these lead generation firms that are out there, right? That are going to be helping, essentially what they're advertising is like, hey, we've got a network of, you know, folks that we're pushing out marketing campaigns or advertising campaigns and different ads all the time, just kind of generic ads, whether it's on the internet, social media, wherever. And then we're gathering a network of kind of names and contact information. And then, you know, we can have some of those folks that are clicking on our stuff that when we say, you know, interested in a financial advisor, and then you click on something and you fill a couple things out, and then they then send some of those contact, they send some of that contact information out to other RIAs. Where, you know, how does that shake out? Because I can see certain instances where, you know, there's some evidence that points to that being a recommendation that's going to track alongside of what you would get with a testimonial endorsement, and other items where other factors may lend people to think that functions more like a marketing service provider or something like that versus a testimonial or endorsement. Maybe Chris, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, if there's any compensation being paid to go into these networks, you know, to sort of solicit clients, you got to think about it. And that's also cited out. That's also cited in the risk alert that the staff observed advisors utilizing lead generation firms, social media influencers, and advisor referral networks offering refer a friend programs to current clients for de minimis compensation. And they go on and say that they did not even think about these. You know, this is an instance where they did not think about these as being endorsements or testimonials. And look, I do want to be real world about this. I mean, there are networking events, right? People do just like we, all of us, like, you know, who are professionals, like we belong to associations. We meet people like that. That's like sort of your job. And so I do think sometimes that line can get a little blurry between people just like going out for drinks or belonging to a group and saying, hey, you know, I know about this advisor. They're good. And that's okay. Right. I mean, you can have friends, you can have social networks, you can refer to people. But if you're giving gift cards or you're providing, you know, compensation to anyone for sort of engaging in those activities or leading a sort of social network, a buzz campaign, right? It is important to realize that there is a line. The line is really mm-hmm. compensation, right? You're paying mm-hmm. them to do that, even if it's yeah. even if it seems like a very small amount of money. The second you do that, you got to understand now it's sort of moved beyond professional networking, and it really has moved into potentially an endorsement.
Well, so I think one way to draw that line, and I hadn't thought about this before, but I'm thinking about the way you couched it, Patrick. So let's say we have an aggregator out there. They have non-RIA specific marketing, you know, just talking about, right. you know, asset allocation models and why you should invest and how investing today helps you toward 30 years from now. And they collect names of people. And then I, the RIA, go out and I buy a list of those names and I pay for that list. I think as long as that aggregator hasn't gone to the end client saying, hey, you should talk to Jeff's firm, I don't think that's an endorsement or a testimony. Well, it wouldn't be a testimony because they're not a client, but I don't think it's an endorsement. But if they say, okay, you bought this name, we're going to go say, hey, you should go talk to Jeff because he does a good job. That's what I think that's what triggers that switch is who's making that initial contact. Is it the referral source or is it the RIA?
Mm-hmm. And what's the compensation potentially, right? Or anything that's being paid for being able to get access to those names.
Well, I mean, but again, you know, if I go to the American Medical Association and I buy a list of the subscribers to the you know, to their journal, and then I send out a marketing blast mm-hmm. of all the people on the AMA mailing list, mm-hmm. that's not an endorsement from the AMA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now, if the AMA sends something out to all their subscribers and says, hey, we have a relationship with Jeff's firm, they do a great job, you should call them, that changes things.
Right, right, right. So thank you both for helping provide that context. I mean, testimonials and endorsements, again, I don't, this is, and what I'm hearing, even just in the conversation around the lead generation firms, is that these are very, very fact intensive analyses that need to occur.
Absolutely. It's always facts and circumstances.
And so it's an art and a science, right? There are parts of the rules that are scientific and technical that we can absolutely build from and use as our initial foundation, but then you're going to have to take each situation on its own merit.
Yeah.
And I think
you know, a really good tip for exams is just put in thought to it, right? I mean, there's not clear answers to these questions oftentimes. And, you know, you want to think about it and you want to make a decision and you want to, you know, if you can document that decision, why you made it. And, you know, examiners may disagree with you, but they will respect the fact that you put in the thought, you tried to use the rule, you tried to reach the right answer, and they disagree with you. But what is harder is when you act surprised, right? And I think that's what happened, you know, just reading some of these lines in this risk alert is like they didn't think about it. They didn't even recognize these things were what would potentially issue. I think that's harder to overcome on an exam than if you stake out a position, it's well reasoned, it's well thought out. You might be wrong or examiners might disagree with you and you can deal with it at that point. But it's good to put in thought to these things and sort of stake out a position.
Yeah.
Well, to that point, Chris, and I assume you'd agree, having been an examiner, if you do all that, if you think about the rule, you document, you know, in your files why you came to the decision you came out to, if the examiners disagree with you, you're going to get a deficiency, sure, but it's highly unlikely, unless somehow there's fraud involved, that you're going to end up in an enforcement action. Because it's absolutely very hard for the examiner to say, well, you ignored it. Well, I didn't. I took the time. I have documentation proving I thought about it. We disagree what the result is, and we'll fix it going forward. Yeah. And that's the end of it right there.
For sure. And it makes it less likely to be a deficiency. You know your business better than examiners do, right? And so if you have a real sort of thoughtful explanation, it makes it less likely you get it. But you're absolutely right. Even if examiners still could disagree with you, it's still a deficiency. But the likelihood of enforcement being rolled up at that point is very, very low, because, you know, that's your job, is to make these hard calls as a compliance officer. You know, I know examiners have a ton of respect for CCOs and how difficult their job is. And you know, what they want is that you actually put in the thought and you reach a reasonable conclusion, and, you know, people can disagree.
To both of your points, make sure to memorialize it.
Yeah. It didn't happen.
Get the credit. You did the work. You did the analysis. Get the credit enough to write it down so that when in an examination that topic comes up, you're able to get the credit for it.
Yeah.
All right.
One thing before we jump to third-party ratings, because we talked about this in the prep and we didn't really get to it, but the disclosure of the compensation, the material terms of compensation, all of us agree. We've gotten pushback from our clients when, you know, if you say, you know, yeah, I just want to say I'm getting paid, right? That we're paying the referral source, and that's it. And that's not sufficient. Yeah. He has made it very clear. You know, if someone's getting 20% of the fees that the referral makes for the life of the relationship, that's what the disclosure needs to say.
Let's stay on that, because that's a good point. I think we can actually flesh out a couple different concepts on compensation stuff and then come back to third-party ratings. Because I totally agree. One, a very frequent question, right, that comes in from lots of different advisors is, okay, I recognize that this is going to qualify as a testimonial or an endorsement. I know I'm going to have to provide a disclosure. How detailed do I need to get, right? Can't I just say that, like, I'm compensating them and that's enough? And I think one of the things that this risk alert makes clear, or helps flesh out, is that, you know, that you should be a little bit more specific than that, right? You can't just say that you're paying somebody. You have to provide a little bit more meaningful detail in there. And so I guess a question for you would be, does that mean I have to give the exact number? You know, does that mean that I can give percentages? You know, what are some thoughts there? Maybe, Chris, let's start with you on this one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, the risk alert cites the release as risk alerts tend to, and the release on page 96 of the market release says, if a specific amount of cash compensation is paid, the advertisement should disclose the amount. Doesn't say must, it says should, which is an interesting term. If the compensation takes the form of percentage over a period of time, the advertisement should disclose such percentage and time period. With respect to non-cash compensation, if the value is readily ascertainable, disclosure should include that amount. So it's important to note that the rule itself says, you know, material terms of compensation. The release provides examples of should. Mm-hmm. You should follow those. But I do think there is, you know, there is a bit more variety, I think, out there than those three examples. That said, I think it's very clear just saying you're paid is definitely not sufficient.
The one place I think saying you're paid is sufficient, in my opinion, is if it meets the de minimis threshold. You could say we pay them a de minimis amount. I think that would be sufficient. Yeah, if it's de minimis, and just to be clear, de minimis is defining the rule.
Right. Because you're basically giving the amount to them.
Exactly. Right. And the SEC made very clear in their risk alert that $1,000 limit is not per payment; it's over the 12 months.
In the aggregate. Very important point, because that you're great. That's a good call out. I've gotten that question a couple different times as well. What about
Patrick, Jeff? I don't know what your taste in wine is, but you gotta be careful when you're sitting up.
$2
Gotta be careful when you're sitting up. Gotta be careful when you're sitting up those bottles of wine, you know.
Right, exactly. What about the use of, and maybe Jeff, I'll go to you on this one. What about the use of like up to a certain amount? Is that something you've seen or use in other disclosures?
I've seen it. I tend not to do that with my clients just because my clients tend not to be variable. They want to say, this is what we pay, and we pay all of our referral sources the same on the same basis. But I have seen that in some that I've reviewed for people, and I think I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah. Anything else as it relates to some of the disclosures around compensation or any other considerations on testimonials and endorsements that you think firms should really keep in mind before they jump into the breach and start using them as part of their advisory business?
Yeah, I mean, I think the due diligence requirement is really important, right? And this is another one where, you know, the oversight component of this, to have a reasonable belief that they're complying, an advisor may provide the required disclosures to a promoter and seek to confirm with the promoter that those disclosures were actually disclosed. The advisor may choose to include those provisions in a written agreement with the promoter, requiring, effectively giving you a breach of contract if the promoter doesn't comply with the provisions. So there are a variety of different ways. There's not one specific way, but that is a really important part. And you do need to be able to demonstrate to examiners that you understand that you still are on the hook and you have the oversight obligation of the promoter, whether it's an endorser or someone provided a testimonial. Like, you do need to have that ability. And so, you know, contractual is probably the easiest, but it's not the only one. And the point is you need to have that evidence. You need to put yourself in the mind, I'm being examined. They're asking this question. What am I going to show them? What physically am I going to show them that can answer that question?
It kind of goes back to the abandoned rule proposal about third-party service providers and the oversight that the SEC expects you to provide. And it goes to any service provider, including promoters and endorsers, which is you can't just set it and forget it. There's an ongoing oversight obligation for any third party you're working with if they're doing something that's even remotely tied to your fiduciary duty to your clients.
And that's you hit the nail on the head too at the end. I totally agree that, like, you can always come back to, again, like, as a fiduciary, if you're acting in the best interest of your clients and or just generally with regard to that high level standard of care, having some ongoing monitoring and supervision of that type of activity would seem paramount.
Yep.
Let's move over to third party ratings and talk about that for a bit. One of the items that's mentioned in the risk alert, and I would love to get both of your takes on this, which is, you know, they mention, they discuss kind of when an advisor has satisfied the requirement of having a reasonable belief that the questionnaires or surveys used in the preparation of the third party ratings were structured to make it equally easy for a participant to provide favorable and unfavorable responses and were not designed to produce any predetermined results. So my question for both of you, and Jeff, I'll pick on you first this time. Where is that line? What would you say is sufficient in that scenario?
See, and that's a great question. And this is why I tell my clients, this is probably an area just to avoid, because I still think there's, even with this risk alert, I think there's too much gray here. There are too many opportunities to get tripped up here. But at a minimum, if you're going to do this, you need to be talking to the provider of the rating and reviewing their methodology, the questionnaire, if they'll give it to you. So, yeah, you can't just ask, was it fair and balanced, and be done. There has to be more to it. You know, I do think that the risk alerts, it implies, if it doesn't expressly say it, saying you don't actually have to look at the questionnaire. There are other ways you can get comfortable, but you need to do more than just say, was this a fair and balanced survey? And
yeah,
it's such It's such a gray area. I mean, that line can change so easily over time, you know, especially depending on the examiner, the commission's perspective. It's going to move over time. It just seems to me that trying to advertise using these third-party ratings is a slippery slope that I tell my clients it's not worth getting into.
Mr. Mulligan, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of publications do put their sort of methodology on their website, and that is a way that I think a lot of advisors get comfortable, sort of, you know, reviewing, you know, that this is done by sending out surveys to X number of random people of investors or clients, asking them rating on a scale of 1 to 10, right? So, you know, I do think there are, maybe I'm a bit more optimistic about the use of third-party ratings. I do think there are ways to do it, because it can often be difficult to get in contact with people who are conducting the survey. And it's honestly, I think where people can get in trouble is where it's an affiliated or entity or entity you're very close with, right? Who has a lot of incentives. It's sort of bizarre. I found that people, this is most likely to be an issue when they actually do know the people conducting the survey, right? Because then they're likely to ask, you know, are they a great advisor or the greatest advisor, right? And sort of that's the scale is like 9 to 10. And that's where you can really get yourself in trouble. If it's a reputable third party that's doing a sort of a reasonably objective, as best you can tell, review of the market or of your fund or what quartile you're in, for example, you know, usually you can piece together enough information from public websites to sort of get comfortable with it.
I would agree with that. I think that's true. I mean, especially if it's a reputable firm that's less concerning. The one big one that concerns me that, you know, I took an ad out in this magazine and then the magazine ranked me in the top 10%, you know.
Yeah.
That concerns me immensely.
Yes.
If the Wall Street Journal or Barron's or some true third party objective publication is going to rate you, you're probably on fairly safe ground, Chris. I would agree with that.
Yeah, and I agree with you. The sort of pay to play ones can be very, because then it's like, are they a third party rating or are they an endorsement? And sometimes it can be very difficult to tell. With some of these magazines where they sort of rate you because you paid the money. It's like, well, I think that's an endorsement, frankly, not a third party rating, because it's not really an objective standard to it. So those can be, yeah. I mean, I think anything where you're getting closer to either you're paying them or there's some sort of, you know, you do this for me, I'll do this for you. Anything like that. That's when I actually started getting nervous. If it's sort of a, you don't really know that entity and you got ranked and, you know, you're generally okay because they usually provide something on their website that you can sort of, get comfortable with in terms of objective standards.
I agree with all of it.
So a couple items. Number one, although seemingly impossible, I'm very pleased to tell you both that you are both number one in the Pat Hayes Power Index. Congratulations on your...
Checks in the mail,
Patrick. I'm putting it on my website.
but separately from that, a couple other items to keep in mind. And again, I'd be interested in both of your thoughts on this as well, which is that, like, okay, always make sure in the disclosures to also provide the date of stuff and like when that's occurring. Cause I've seen plenty of stuff that will say greatest advisor of all time award. And there's no date
20 years ago.
Right. And that perfect segue, Mr. Blumberg, because my next comment was going to be, and this is a question that I've seen come up, you know, fairly common. How old does an award get when it becomes too stale? Right. Or like, you know, not necessarily meaningful. I mean, is it essentially like, look, like, let's say I was a top advisor in the state of Ohio, in 2017, right? Or even 2014, right? And it's 2026 now. Let's just do the 2017 one because it's right at about that 10-year mark. We're getting close to that, right? So that happened 9 years ago. You know, if I appropriately keep the date on it, can I use it in perpetuity, or does it start to get into that, like, you know, you're saying you're a top advisor, but that was 10 years ago. Is that getting a little bit misleading? Anyway, would welcome both of your thoughts there. Chris, I picked on Jeff last time, so I'll pick on you first this time.
I think it's an interesting question. I this was actually something we thought a lot about at the SEC. What I sort of discovered in the real world, though, is the commercial and IR implications really step in, because it gets kind of embarrassing to write, "I was a top advisor." And this is sort of what this rule, because the rule requires you to put the date on it.
Yeah.
It would have been easy before this rule to just say, "I'm a top advisor," and it was in, 2002, and you just keep saying top advisor. By requiring the date on there, the commercial realities, I think, move in almost sooner than any sort of materiality, because it's sort of embarrassing to say I was a top advisor at some year. And that might be different for different people. Some people might be comfortable with 10 years ago or 5 years ago or, but I think once you start getting, probably past 10 years, it sort of makes it look like you're in the prime of your career, Patrick, but on the downswing of things.
It begs the question, what happened the last 10 years? Why didn't you get it? But I mean, I think I agree. I mean, my position, Chris, would be, if you put the date, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
But would you be embarrassed to say I was a top advisor in 2003 and it's now 2026?
Yeah. It reminds me.
It was a more interesting question, frankly, to me when I was at the SEC than being on this side of it, because it just seems like there's a commercial reality that steps in that sort of takes that question off the table.
For those Anchorman fans out there, it reminds me of Will Ferrell saying, "We've been coming to the same party for 10 years, and in no way is that embarrassing."
Well, I think a more interesting question here, Patrick, would be, you get it in 2022, you get it in 2025, and you say, "Best advisor, 2022-25.
I don't think you could do it. That's a comma.
If you do a comma, you're fine. You put the dash, and you're implying it's every year since, and that you can't do.
Yeah, I would agree.
And the other thing is context, too, right? I mean, so there's things in biographies, right? So you might have a senior statesman type at your firm, and maybe their awards are a little bit older. That's fine. To me, that's not, you put it in the biography, in 2014, he was the best advisor in the world. Well, it's okay. You have a younger team of people that you're advertising. And I don't think that's misleading. You've got the year on there. It's really more about his sort of biography. So I do think the context of it depends as well.
That's like my bio saying I was, 40 under 40 20 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, some greatness never goes away, Jeff. What can you say? Gentlemen, this has been insanely helpful. And I am so appreciative of all of your thoughts and wonderful feedback on all of this. As we look to close up a shop here on our conversation today, any quick, snippets or bites or best practices that, again, kind of just considerations for firms to keep in mind if they may be, going down this path and starting to use testimonials, endorsements, or third-party ratings?
I think we can say it in a way that I think the SEC politically can't. Read the damn rule.
Yeah.
Fair. Take the time. Read the rule. Parse through it very, very closely, very carefully, and make sure you address all the things the rule brings up. And you'll get 90% of the way there just by doing that.
Yeah. My advice, particularly for private fund advisors, which is where I spend a lot of my time, is take the long view, because these documents live for a very long time, right? So if you're in a 10, 12-year-old fund, you're raising a fund today, it might be, it might be an examiner in who, is 15 years old right now. And, will graduate college in 20, 40 or whatever, who's looking at this, right? So you got to build this for the long haul. You got to think about this for the long haul. When you take risks, you want to be really thoughtful about why you're taking risks. But these documents are going to live on for a very long period of time across many different administrations with many different exam priorities and examiners. So really take the long view when you think about the market.
That's a great point. That's a great point, Chris.
Fantastic advice from both of you. But, per usual, I'm not going to let you get off with just that easy of a last question. So I'm going to give you the really tough question here at the end.
Niners.
Who wins the Super Bowl? Blumberg, starting with you.
I just said it. Go Niners.
Go Niners. Okay.
Been a Niners fan since college. So,
Mr. Mulligan, who you got?
I have to say the Patriots are looking really good. Drake May's looking very, very good.
That, and I'm going to make it 3 for 3 on different teams. I think kind of a dark horse, Seattle. I like Seattle. Yeah, they look really good. They look real good. So, all right. So, well, we'll see how terribly wrong we all were here in about about a month. And thank you, gentlemen, both very much for the time today. Great to have you on, and looking forward to having you both back on the show here at some point down the road.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite, Patrick.
Thanks, Patrick.
The final part of today's show features another segment of Outtakes. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, if compliance were a TV show, think of this as the bloopers reel, where we look at entertaining, sometimes humorous, and always unsettling activities carried out at financial services firms that hopefully provide us all with a roadmap of what not to do when facing a similar situation or trying to avoid a similar compliance breakdown inside our respective firms. Essentially, leave these activities on the cutting room floor and outside your compliance program. Earlier this month, the SEC charged 3 brothers and 3 associates with orchestrating a market manipulation and insider trading ring involving pharmaceutical stocks and stolen clinical trial data. According to a complaint filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of New Jersey, the defendants manipulated the share prices of 2 pharmaceutical companies. The SEC alleged the brothers impersonated physicians to steal confidential information regarding clinical trials. The SEC claimed the brothers stole the identities of cancer patients from online forums and published falsified clinical trial results, artificially inflating the company's stock price to sell their positions for profit. The SEC went on to claim the operation also included an insider trading scheme facilitated by a co-defendant employed as an investment banker. The SEC alleged that the banker misappropriated material non-public information from his firm regarding 9 potential corporate acquisitions and tipped the brothers. This, they said, allowed the ring to purchase securities of the target companies before the deals were announced. The SEC said this pattern of manipulation and insider trading occurred over a nearly 4-year period, generating approximately $41 million in illicit profits. The SEC charged the defendants with violations of the Securities Act, Section 17A, the use of interstate commerce for the purpose of fraud or deceit, and the Securities Exchange Act, Section 10B, regarding regulation of the use of manipulative and deceptive devices, as well as 14E for proxies, as well as Section 10B5 of the Securities Exchange Act rules regarding employment of manipulative and deceptive devices. In addition, they were charged with violations of Section 14E3 of the Securities Exchange Act regarding transactions in securities on the basis of material non-public information in the context of tender offers. The SEC in this case is seeking permanent injunctions, disgorgement of ill-gotten gains with prejudgment interest, civil penalties, and a permanent bar prohibiting the investment banker defendant from acting as or being associated with any broker, dealer, or investment advisor. In a parallel action, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of New Jersey has announced criminal charges against the brothers and their associates. Under a Paul Atkins-led SEC, we continue to see enforcement sharpening its focus on these types of cases of investor fraud and market manipulation and abuse over enforcement focused on, say, per se violations of the rules that might have been more prevalent under former Chair Gensler. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CalFee and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Jeff Blumberg and Chris Mulligan, for coming on the show today and sharing their fantastic insights on the SEC marketing rule and some of the recent risk alert and FAQ related guidance. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast or on X using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.